We cannot just talk about mind transformation. We cannot talk about helping leaders out there. We cannot talk about influencing those upcoming leaders and those who want to be the best in what they do if we cannot be able to tap, you know, from the experiences of those who've been in these levels of positions, who've gone through these paths. Because it's something that's very important that we have to be able to learn from the masters. We've got to be able to learn from others who have been down that road. Because if we don't do that, we're going to repeat the same mistakes over and over again. Hi, my name is Belindaba, the neuroengineer and the author of The Neuroscience of Effective Leadership. And I'm all about transforming minds from a place of mental darkness to mental light. Hi, my name is Belindaba, the neuroengineer. I'm all about transforming minds from a place of mental darkness to mental light. And that's what my passion is all about. And there's a book that has just come out around that, which has got to do with the neuroscience of effective leadership that you don't want to miss, because this is the book that's going to change you and that's going to change your team, because change starts with you. If you are not willing to change, and there's no way that you can change other people. And that's something that I'm really, really passionate about. And I'm all about helping teams. I'm all about helping people raise their self-awareness. And if you are not willing to raise your self level of awareness, you'll always be stuck in your own perspectives that are no longer serving you. And we are building this kind of leaders because we want to create awareness around great leadership. And we're not just talking about leadership, but we're talking about effective leadership. And this is one of the reasons why I even authored a book about effective leadership. It's not just about leaders and leadership, but we need to be very specific around that. And I'm just so excited and so thrilled, you know, to be joined once again in this episode by one of our, I wouldn't say powerful, but one of the insightful and one of the, you know, the great leaders that we have that we're going to be engaging with and that will be, you know, sharing some ideas with. Just talking about this issue of effective leadership. And the person is Bedelia Tennyson. And Bedelia is actually an executive. And Bedelia is an industrial psychologist. And this is something that she will maybe just tell us about in terms of what it is, this industrial psychology. As an industrial psychologist, she holds a master's degree in industrial psychology. And she's had a number of executive roles, you know, in different organizations. You know, organizations like MTN, organizations like IBM, organizations like APSA, organizations like PricewaterhouseCoopers, like organizations like NetBank and Standard Bank. And wow, it's such an exciting and plum-pleasing pleasure for me just to introduce to you our guest for this episode, which happens to be in December, by the way. And please help me welcome Bedelia Tennyson. Bedelia, good morning to you.
Good morning, Veli, and thank you so much for the invitation.
Thank you so very kind. You know, we shared a platform recently in one of the conferences, and I thought to myself, wow, the authenticity that came through and the power that came through, you actually, you know, did so well, and you could have seen the feedback that was received, you know, after your talk. It was such a powerful talk, and I thought to myself, you know what, I've got to host, you know, Bedelia, and right away, and I approached you, and you said, yes, I would love to do that, and thank you so very kindly once again for coming. And for those that have not had the pleasure of meeting you, I'd like you maybe just to give us a little bit of background about who you are and, you know, and how was your upbringing like? You know, what did you see? What did you observe? What is it that may have influenced you to be the person that you are? And then maybe soon after that, you can just talk to us about your qualification as an industrial psychologist, you know, having a master's in industrial psychology. What is this industrial psychology? Why is it important to have in the first place? And I think we can take it from there.
Thank you very much. I think absolutely privileged to be part of this. And yes, I absolutely enjoy the talent conference. And I think, you know, when I went there, I was like, okay, who can I connect with? who did God send me to soul? And I think yourself and two other ladies whom I've also met in this time, because for me it's always important to pay it forward.
Yes,
we need each other, and we got so much to learn from each other. So I think for me, I come from the cliche of very humble beginnings. I grew up in Westbury, and I think I was very fortunate. I always tell people, you know what, I'm the previously disadvantaged, but I've never seen me as disadvantaged.
Yeah.
Because my parents never made me feel disadvantaged. They gave us the best in terms of what they could give us. And, you know, they also brought us up to be very independent, and also to shape and guide who you want to be, what you want to do. So you had freedom within a framework, as AECI would call it. But really that you make your decisions and you take accountability for the decisions that you make. And you are allowed to make the mistakes. So I think a lot of that shaping has really defined my leadership style and who I am, and how I then evolved into being the person that I am today. And yes, am I getting it always right? No. And you know, I've got three kids, 17-year-old, that normally shows me my Johari window, and that's absolutely amazing because I've got a Gen Z that is able to show me the mirror. So to answer your question in terms of where do I come from, I do come from Westbury. I think a very challenging community. It wasn't always easy growing up there. At times it was very tough. Schooling was very tough. You had teachers. My primary school for me was the most amazing. I had very dedicated teachers. I had teachers that was very committed to the cause, very committed to the individual. There's a few very precious teachers, some of them that have left the world now, but they really instilled something very deep in me. And I think what it was for me is that deep compassion and care, and really wanting to make a difference and to see the difference. High school for me was a different, I think a very different feeling. It was about teachers doing the job because it's a job, and not really having real commitment in terms of where you go to, what you do. So I had to really adopt different skills. I really had to dig deep in terms of saying, you know what, I want to get out of the community. I want to strive beyond this. And how do I do that? And I think I was also fortunate. And I always say, you know, there's a fine line between fortunate and God's will. Because one of the teachers exposed me to what was called ProTech at that stage. And they offered free maths and science lessons. So I took the opportunity with both hands and started going there. I then also used the skills that I got at ProTech to come back into the community and also, you know, coach the students that I was with to make sure that, you know, a lot of us will get through high school. A lot of us will matriculate. So I'll never forget, we were five friends that you used to, let's call it, tutor the others. And a very strong bond that have been created. But it was really about showing independence, not having reliance on the teachers, because the curriculum was not going to happen. I mean, there was really things, you know, that we don't talk about always, but there was literally times where you had teachers that was not, you know, capable of teaching you today because they either had a hangover or whatever the case may be. So it was about saying, guys, if we don't do it for ourselves, nobody's going to do it for us. And I think, you know, that resilience that went with it. And I think, you know, for me, my role models during that time was my parents. My dad was a very hardworking man. I can't remember or recall a day that he was off sick at home. Doesn't matter how he felt, he would get up and he would go and, you know, fend for his family. My mom was a stay-at-home mom, but very, very strong-willed, and she ran that household like an executive.
Wow.
And, you know, just the moments when you were psychologically not well, she would pick it up. And without saying much, she would just be there for you.
Wow.
She was the place that we go to, you know, to hang out after school. So absolutely amazing. And then the other role models in my life was my grands, so my grandfather, my grandmother. I used to go there quite often, and one of my fondest memories of them is I used to pick them up for church. So I used to walk to them, get them, and then walk them to church. It was a long journey because they weren't crutches. But I think with my grandfather, it was always before you go into the house, you stand outside and you're like, oh, what words is he going to ask me to know in the dictionary? Because that's literally what he did. And that made and gave me my love for reading. Because before I went in there, I had to go and tell stories, and I had to go and say definitions. And my grandmother would just be silently sitting there, very strong. She was also very involved in the community. So, you know, a lot of, I think, what they've shaped me really came from there. So, yes, we've got our role models that, you know, the big ones in the world.
Yes,
but I think those foundings and foundations for me was what shaped me.
Wow, fantastic. I really love that, because that actually tells you, and I love what you've just said, that when you look at our role models, we've got the big ones in the world, but there are these small ones that are shaping us, that are closest to us. You know, our parents, our siblings, you know, our neighbors, community members. And we learn a lot from them, because you look up to them and say, wow, I'd like to be like that person one day. And it starts with that. That's why the environment that you find yourself in is very, very influential in the person that you become. And now I can have a sense in terms of what drove you to choose industrial psychology.
So from a very early age, I wanted to be a psychologist. And it was really, so what drew me to you is the fascination about neuroscience. So how the mind works, why we do what we do. So for me, that was always something that intrigued me. And originally, I was going to become a clinical psychologist.
Wow. Okay.
So you would see that I have done an honors in psychology and then an honors in industrial psychology. So in my undergraduate, I did both. And you know, sometimes we stuck in our minds, we're going to go this journey. But when I was doing undergrad, I was more pulled towards industrial psychology and understanding organizations and, you know, what makes people react in a way that they do in organizations. And then I did my honors in psychology, and I was well en route to clinical psychology. At the end of that, I was like, is this really what I want to do? And then I then decided to do the honors in industrial psychology. Yep. And make an informed decision. So it was, for me, an investment in another year so that I can know what's my true path. So I did that, and I absolutely, I think also the group that I was in, we had an amazing time. And also, you know, doing internships and vacation work and things like that. So I was like, no, definitely industrial psychologist. So I want to be where things happen and not just sit and engage with one-on-ones, but also to influence very much groups and organizations and shape the leaders of tomorrow. So that is where a lot of the passion went into. So I then went full-fledged into industrial psychology. And yes, I am now in for about 23 years and have not looked one day back. In the industrial psychology space, I think for me, what really sets it aside is, yes, you work in the human resources or human capital environment. But what has always made a difference is the understanding of human behavior, understanding the neuroscience behind it, understanding the psyche, why does people do what they do,
yes.
And then combined with the organizational life cycles.
Yes.
So for me, it was always very important to help shape where the organization is at, what type of leaders you then need for that time because not you don't need the same type of leadership styles within the whole journey of the organization. If you're going through change, you're going to need a different type of leader. If you're going to go through a maintenance phase, it's a different type of leader. I think what's very interesting in terms of where I found my personal leadership style is that God have always seen me with his change.
Yes.
So I've never been in an organization or a role where I really maintained. And sometimes, you know, it was like, maybe you should eat the fruits. But then there's things that happens in my life that actually pushes me out.
Yes.
And I find myself in another change. So I've made peace with the fact that I'm used as a change agent.
Yeah.
And a lot of that I've spent in terms of leadership coaching and helping leaders to navigate through that change.
Yes.
And a lot of the times, I will tell you, Valley, it is not the technical skills.
Yes.
It is about the inherent leadership qualities.
Yes.
It is about, you know, the conversations that you have in terms of how do I set myself up for success?
Yes.
Or what are the things that I need to look out in terms of going through demise?
Yes.
So for me, I think it's been a hard journey at a lot of times, but a very powerful journey at the same time.
Wow, that's very powerful, and I love it. And that leads me to maybe the next question. I mean, like, you've been involved in these different companies. I mean, not just small companies, but huge organizations that have been involved in, and at executive roles as well. And I think that's something that cannot be taken lightly. So you understand, you know, the nitty-gritties of what is happening and some nuances as well when it comes to culture, organizational cultures, I mean, that you've been in. And I just want to know from you, how would you define this organizational culture? And how important is organizational culture, you know, in driving either change or in producing results that are sustainable? Why is culture need to be there?
I think culture is probably the next buzzword now. First, it was change management, and I think it's now shifted to culture. And I think a lot of the times, culture is very undervalued because it's so inherent in the organization. It is what people do on a daily basis. It is the way that people show up. It is in the little things. It's not the big things. It is what gets done in that organization on a daily basis. How does people act? How does people speak to each other? So I think, you know, there's lots of definitions for culture, but culture for me is the rituals.
Yes.
It's the said and the unsaid rituals.
Yes.
And deeply rooted, because we can have policies, we can have guidelines.
Yes.
It's nowhere in there. That's not the culture.
And as we talk about that as well, because I see culture as a culmination of, you know, core values, company core values, where things get written down to say we stand for transparency, we stand for excellence, we stand for, you know, for teamwork.
Mm.
And what does the company strive for in terms of values, you know, that gets written down.
Okay.
So when you get those, you know, translated into those rituals, it becomes a powerful culture. Because I think what tends to be a problem is that you've got values that are written down, but they are not in alignment with what is being lived on a day-to-day basis. Have you ever experienced something like that, where they say, no, these are our company values, and then when you look at the realities, it's not that? You know, maybe, have you ever experienced that? And what do you think is the main cause of that deviation?
I think I have experienced it. And I've also experienced where there was a lot of work done in terms of bringing the two together.
Yes.
So a lot of the companies you walk in, and obviously when you go through, I call it a courting phase.
Yeah.
The courting phase.
Yes, okay.
Before you go for the interview, you're going to look at the values, you're going to look at the organizational dynamics, you know, in terms of how does the website look? Because in that, it tells you a lot of how the culture is.
Yes.
You know, is it easy to navigate? Do they only profile their top leaders, or is there stories about other people? It says a lot from the onset.
Okay.
And then obviously one of the big things that you look at is the values, and what does the value stand for? And those are the things that actually makes you arrive at an interview. Those are the things that when you get the offer, actually makes you accept the offer.
Yes.
Together with How did you experience the panel that interviewed you? And most important for me, it's always been the leader. So there's been jobs that I've declined because I felt that the leader would be stifling my growth or something like that.
Yes.
So for me, I've always looked at the leader first and then the organization. So I think that actually says what a great role leadership plays.
Yes.
But in terms of bringing it together, I think it's so important to involve every single person in the organization to say, this is our vision. This is where we are striving to go. And how and what is your role that you need to play in this? So one of the organizations that I think was, you know, for me, the best practice, it was in the early 2000s when APSA amalgamated all their banks, so Volks, Gus, and Trust Bank, etc. I was very fortunate to be part of that journey. And we started with, redefining the strategy, redefining the purpose, the values, and we were able to put in a lot of creativity into this. And one of the things was change management, and change management being very key, so that you are able to communicate with everybody, you are able to bring everybody on this journey.
Yes.
And we designed the concept of the tablecloth.
Okay.
So it was literally a tablecloth that was designed, and we put people through workshops. So it wasn't about, you know, you get collateral or emails or things like that. It was conversations in a room.
Okay.
So you have a room full of about 20 people, because also if you go beyond that, you're not able to get the voice of everybody.
Yes.
So then you would present in terms of, this is the purpose, this is the strategy, this is the company values. But you actually let people engage with that intimately to say, yes, what is my purpose,
yes,
my personal purpose,
yes,
what is my personal values, and then looking at them to say, how is this aligned or not aligned? If not, how do I align, or what feedback do I need to give back to leadership in terms of some of these values? And then from there, the journey is then empowering leaders so that they can take on the leadership role in terms of, so, okay, we've defined our values, now you understand it. How do we inculcate this in every process that we've got?
Yes.
So making sure that from a performance management process, they are able to have conversations with their people. They are able to translate that into career conversations, into succession. And we also gave them a tool. In companies that I've gone, I've always said, you know, the 6-question dipstick.
Okay.
And it really was a leadership conversation tool.
Okay.
For a leader to understand, how do I feel about the organization? How do I feel about my leader? How do I feel about my remuneration? How I'm recognized? My team? And then the culture. And using that as a one-on-one conversation, which is literally like a 5-minute conversation, but to see where the person is at.
Yes.
And what you find is that it elicitate or enhance the conversation so much that it opens the avenue for a leader to do personalized offerings for individuals, because I think that is actually the need of where we are going. No longer do we have this, you know, mass needs.
Yes.
People have individual needs, and where we thought we knew what were the needs. So for instance, after COVID, there was a lot of perceptions about women needs flexibility.
Yes.
But we've been proven wrong, because men wants the same flexibility.
Wow. And now, you know, with that culture, and we talk about things like, you know, there's something called developmental readiness, you know, where especially leaders need to be willing to develop themselves, because if they don't do that, or they won't do it, so it simply means that those people that they lead, they will suffocate. And I'm going to have spoken about that, because that's one of the core human needs.
Mm-hmm.
When you talk about development, growing and learning as a person, it's a core need. And if that is not met, then it becomes a problem, because people end up suffocating. And when you look at some leaders, because let's be honest, I mean, globally, leadership is under siege. This is where now leaders are said to be not in tune with those people that they lead. So that's why I call, even in the book, I mean, leadership darkness, because they seem to be just taking a stroll, you know, because if you are trying to lead people and no one is following you, you are just taking a stroll in the park, you know. So it comes back to the issue of connecting with your people. So my question is, maybe what's your take around leadership darkness. Why do you think leaders are in the dark? Why do you think there's so much leadership toxicity? Why do you think people are complaining so much, you know, with their leaders, that leaders are just, they seem to be just doing things for themselves or just focusing on the bottom line, you know, only and forgetting about people? What's your take on that? You know, why do you think, is it a lack of development? Is it maybe things like premature promotions, where leaders are quickly, you know, getting promoted without having enough, you know, experience in terms of how to deal with people? Is it just focusing on bottom line? I know it's a loaded question, but I'm just giving you some different perspectives. Maybe what's your take on that?
Look, I think we can sit and talk about that for ages.
Absolutely.
It's my favorite topic, leadership. But I think for me, there's probably three elements that I would cap that under. And the one is that we promote people for performance, not necessarily for leadership capability. So you take the high-performing specialist and you make them a leader.
Yes.
So that for me is a risk number one. And obviously with that is the old way of thinking about leadership or growth.
Yes.
Because up is the only way.
Yes.
And if you want to progress or if you feel that you need to grow, it's about levels. It's not about the personal growth. So I think that is some of the thinking that needs to shift.
And that one, I love that. You know, that we are promoting people for performance, you know, not because of their leadership sort of like capacity, you know, that they are willing, to do that. So do you think, is that done to appease or just to keep those individuals that are called top talent or something? Why do you think that's the way? Is it just about them, or what can you say about that?
Look, I think what I've learned in my experience, it is one about retention. Because everybody wants to feel that they are progressing. Everybody feels that's the form of recognition.
Yes.
But I think where we are stuck is in terms of how we still view growth, how we view organizational levels, organizational hierarchy.
Yes.
So what I've introduced in many of the companies that I've gone to, AECI being the latest, was when I stepped in, there was the concept of high flyers.
Yes.
And that was not defined in terms of, so what does a high flyer mean?
Yes.
It was just the person that's got the high performance. And therefore, if you are identified as a high flyer, you will then get the promotion in terms of the next role. So what I've done is to split it out and say there are high potential individuals and there are high performers. You're still going to recognize them and you're still going to reward them in a similar way. But the high performers are your highly specialized individuals that's got scarce skills, critical skills, and they're not going to be the next GM or the next manager.
Yes.
But the people in the high potential category are the ones that is in your succession pool.
Yes.
So differentiating those two, and also then making sure that your learning and development offerings are then also differentiated.
Yes.
So your high potential individuals are then the people you're going to put on your management and leadership development programs. Your specialist, you may say, you know what, rather go do your master's or your PhD. That is going to suit you better than to go on a Harvard or INSEAD leadership program. So that is how I then differentiate. And then you make sure that the remuneration and the reward is on both sides.
Absolutely. Because, you know, that's why we call it technical stream and leadership stream.
Correct.
Because the problem is it gets mixed up. Someone is so great technically, and then they get promoted now automatically to this leadership stream because the company doesn't have this kind of, you know, approach or system where we are saying you're promoting both, you know, but a person is going to be promoted based on where they're at, you know, in terms of their strength.
And at APSA, you will hear me speak very fondly of him. It was my first.
Your first,
So at APSA, there was broadbanding, and the broadbanding had broad streams.
Yes.
So even in terms of the levels, it catered for both.
Yes.
So you would have, for instance, on a management level, you would have an M level, which was your general manager.
Yes.
And you would have a P level, which was your specialist.
Yes.
So you could see progress in both streams.
Yes.
And that proved to be very successful.
And maybe while we're on that one, we're still now on one of three. It was just very exciting.
Yes.
I mean, like in terms of the approach and how you packaged it. And why would you say maybe other organizations are actually lagging behind or failing dismally, you know, on introducing that structure where you are able to remunerate equally, you know, based on a person's or employee's strength, you know, technically and as well as leadership, because you've got high flyers, as it were, and as well as you've got high potential, you know, candidates that can be developed into leadership.
Mm.
Why do you think there's a pushback or there's a lack of that understanding or knowledge, or why do you think they are lacking? Because I mean that is supposed to be, you know, in all organizations.
In my experience, the organizations that I've experienced in that ways was either there's a lack of knowledge,
okay,
or a resistance to change.
Yes.
And wanting to keep the old. So I think for me those two factors were always the two that came out more prominent than anything else.
Wow, fantastic. Thank you very much. I think we've exhausted. I know we can carry on with the first one. I mean, still there are other issues. Maybe let's move on to your next point. Yes.
The next one for me is a lack of confidence.
Okay.
And the third one would be overconfidence. I think the two speaks, you know, almost in intertwined to each other.
Yes. Okay.
So the one is where a leader doesn't have the self-confidence.
Okay.
And with that, we spoke about self-awareness earlier.
Yes.
On. So not understanding where their gaps are, what they need to develop.
So and the Johari window.
The Johari window, correct.
Yes. Okay.
And then obviously also with that, I think also in terms of very linked to the organizational culture.
Okay.
Is this a culture where you can speak up and you can say, I have a development area, I lack this,
yes,
and please can I be developed in that?
Yes.
So you will find that people don't have the confidence probably to speak up and say, you know what, I've got a problem.
Yes.
And, you know, also probably fearing the consequences of if I speak up, what will then happen?
Yes.
So for me, that's the one side. Then the other side is the overconfidence, where you've got leaders that believe that they don't need teams to help them succeed and that they know everything. And also that, you know, they know more than their team. And my philosophy has always been that, you know what, I'm going to surround myself with people who complement my weaknesses.
Yes.
And that is then what makes us a success. So when I have big projects, I will always pull the team into one room and say, we've got this project. And who wants to do what? Because you will find people putting up their hands where they've got passion or where they've got a strength. And within that, you land things so much quicker, so much more effective. And the passion that goes with that is, you know, it's literally like a candle lighting each other.
Yes. And when you say that, you know, in many organizations, I mean, people talk about toxic leaders, to say this leader is known to be toxic, this one is beating people down, this one is killing the morale, and this one is doing this. But you find that nothing much is done about those. And the others, they know, because there's one of the studies as well that has been released by the Center for Creative Leadership, which indicates that over 70% of the people that were surveyed, I mean, globally, they don't trust it. I mean, HR, they don't believe in HR. And there's that kind of very tricky relationship, because now whenever they're asked to go, you know, they say, go and report it to HR, and they say, no, but it's going to be the same thing, because even if I go there, it's going to even get worse, because, I mean, they cannot keep secrets, and they cannot be able to, you know, like, it means confidentiality is not maintained. And with that statistic coming out, surely it's glaring. I mean, I'm sure it's an indictment from, I mean, like, to HR as well. And why do you think maybe there's a lack of consequence management, you know, when it comes to organizations where the culprits are known, I'll say culprits are known, and yet nothing much is done about it?
I think for me, I've been blessed to be in organizations where there was the most amazing human capital teams, trusted advisors, and very valued. And I've also been in organizations where exactly the scenario that you have sketched is the thing. And I think because my entry was the trusted advisor, it was always a culture shock when I go to into organizations where HR is not. Because, you know, I'm a strong believer of the Dave Ulrich model that says that you need to be a change agent, you need to be there for the senior managers, but you're equally an employee champion. So that is always how I've driven my roles. But I think one of the greatest deficits in organizations is that we only measure and reward the technical skills and a lot of the financial elements. The behavioral elements is seldom in a performance conversation or logged on a performance management process. So I think for me that is where a lot of, I think, growth can happen, where behaviors are called out and where teams take accountability actually for it, because it's not about one person calling out another person, but a team starting to shape the behaviors and the values that they want in the organization. And that not many companies have.
Yeah, which is very, it's very disturbing, because, I mean, when you look at many studies, I mean, there's also one, I mean, like there's some cases that I've shared in the book as well. Case Western University, I mean, like Riverside, they actually presented a paper on that. I mean, they did a lot of things from fMRI scans where it was shown that, you know, there are two neural pathways or networks. One is about resonant leadership, and the other one is about dissonant leadership. Resonant leadership is it's all about, or resonant leaders are the ones that are able to resonate, you know, with their people, with their teams, where they challenge them in a way of, you know, to grow. And they make them feel that they belong. Whereas the other ones are called micromanagers, because they never give you space. You know, they just tell you need to follow the instruction without really thinking. I think with all the information coming out now, but because of focusing on the bottom line, and people end up not really looking at those things and saying, we need to call them out, because you may get the results now, but they're not sustainable. Simply because people are not happy. And you end up having people who are sick. And then right now we've got what is called quiet quitting, you know, which has been there.
Right.
Yes, and it's simply because people are not happy. We talk about things like psychological safety, but is it really applied? It becomes like, you know, one of the buzzwords. Oh no, we need psychological safety and whatever, but at the end of the day, you know, those things are not applied. And yet they are spoken about, but nothing gets done. Now, it becomes an issue of who holds those leaders accountable. I mean, if a leader is known not to be treating employees well, and who's supposed to hold them accountable?
I think for me, it is the 360 is the best.
Yes.
Because it's not about, you know, we need to move away from this hierarchical. So you can say, you know, you've got shareholders, you've got the board, you've got this, you've got that. But it is important for the 360 conversations to start happening. So did teams start keeping each other accountable? Because if it is, for instance, I am courageous enough to give feedback about my leader, it may be seen as you've got something personal or whatever the case may be, but if it is teams that comes together, I think you see a greater shift.
Yes.
But it has to be done in a very constructive manner as well, because it's about growth and not about victimization.
Absolutely. So that must start from the top.
Yeah.
Obviously, where people are held accountable, and then it must be filtered down.
It must be filtered down.
Yes. And now, when you talk about things like effective leadership, how can we be able to develop that, you know, in organizations? Because I think that's something that's very important. You know, leaders that are able to encourage people, leaders that are able to get people to work together as a team and to be able to express themselves, because that's what psychological safety is about. It's about being able to take risks, is being able to ask questions that may make other people feel uncomfortable. But it means you are being yourself, but within, obviously, boundaries. You can't just be, you know. And in those organizations where that has worked, and to those ones that maybe where you feel like that has not worked, what advice would you give to those where psychological safety, for an example, is not, you know, applied?
So I think for me, in the organizations that it's work, is where there was leadership buy-in and leadership support. And leaders actually, it starts with them. So again, I will use, you know, in the 2000s, the APSA models.
Yes.
Because from the leaders, they went on shifting leadership behaviors and self-mastery and all of those things. So it was them understanding themselves first.
Yes.
Because a lot of that is also, how do I manage diversity? How do I manage diversity in terms of all elements that it is encompassed? How do I become an inclusive leader? What does that mean?
Yes.
So being able to understand that, and then you being able to take that message down to the next level. So I think a lot of times also we outsource a lot of stuff to consultants. But okay, the organizations where it's worked the best was actually upskilling your line leaders to become those change agents that takes the messaging forward. And also to have this aligned message that, you know, if X, then Y is the consequence.
Yes.
And from a behavioral perspective. And the first point of call is always, how do we correct it? Because you also don't want to create it into a punitive culture. But how do we correct it?
Wow. I just love this. And I know it, you know, it's something that, you know, we can call this like, you know, like the first episode, you know, of us delving into this. Now, because of time, I just want to find out from you. Now, as a as a female leader, I'm sure you see where I'm going. Do you think, you know, what's your take? I'm sure you've been in a very, you know, awkward position. What did you say about women leaders? Do you think they are playing the role maybe that is expected of them? And if not, why not? And I'm just saying that because, you see, I mean, something has been said to say women leaders, they bring in that softness. You know, but I've heard a lot of other team members complaining about their women leaders to say they seem even to get to be worse than, you know, their male counterparts. Why do you think is that? Maybe just, you know, I know you have experienced that kind of stuff as well. Why do you think that's the case?
So I think the feedback that I got all my life was authenticity. The one thing that I've been, let's call it, tarnished in organizations is my honesty and my candidacy. So yeah, I'm going to continue with it.
Well done.
Because I think, you know, yes, sometimes, you know, it comes with a lot of negativity.
Yes.
But I've also seen a lot of growth that takes place in either organizations or in individual because nobody bothered to give the honest or the candid feedback.
Yes.
So your statement, I think, is absolutely spot on. In my career, I've been heard most by female leaders, female bosses that I've had. And I'm not sure exactly, I can only speculate. So for me, I think that is either the overconfidence or the lack of confidence that I felt played a role. And you know that I was not supported as in the way that I should have been supported. And some of the greatest leaders that I've had was male leaders.
Wow.
And it was really male leaders that have walked a journey in terms of understanding diversity, different people's needs, or most importantly, that have gone through loss in life.
Yes.
So I think that lack of, or the emphasis on compassion and empathy and life experience.
Yes.
Because sometimes I look at people and I think, wow, it doesn't sound like you've ever had adversity in your life. Or if you had, you had not learned lessons. Because if you have gone through adversities in life, you just become such a compassionate leader.
Yes.
Because you, when somebody tells you something, you step into their shoes.
You can relate.
You can relate.
Yes.
And you also look in terms of, so what are you not telling me? And I think that is a skill that needs to be enhanced with leaders, because sometimes people will tell you something, but there's so much more that they are not telling you. And yeah, it's for you then to tap in and to provide that safe space where people will start sharing. And you know, and to provide the support, because you're not always going to be that support, but that's why we've got, you know, wellness offerings within an organization. and you can refer people or whatever the case may be. But I think for me, very concerning is the thing about, you know, females. And you know what I found most disappointing is that a lot of us goes on social media. That's why I'm not the big social media poster. But a lot of people brand themselves so well on social media.
Female leaders, or in general?
Let's say in general, but okay. Because of the female leaders that I've been exposed to, yes. And I'll speak from that perspective, yes. Is that they brand themselves so amazingly on social media and the selfies. And then I look at that and then I thought, you know, I was one of those females, you didn't do that. So I think for me, that is then where the authenticity that comes through, then I'm like, are you really doing this? Did you change? Was it just me? What was it about me? And, you know, I've stopped doing that.
Yes.
Because that's a form of abuse.
Yes.
You know, where you keep trying to find what did you do that they treated you like that.
Yes.
So that's why you won't always find me on social media. Because,
no,
you know,
I've
if
noticed.
I'm not going to share... If I'm not going to share the challenges, why would I share the good stuff only?
Absolutely. And thank you. That's one of the reasons, actually, why I reached out to you, you know, because of that level of authenticity. Because these are things, you know, here in this platform, we don't just talk about this, you know, like the fluffy stuff and that. We just want to talk about things that most people are even scared of talking about. And like what we've just shared, I mean, it's something powerful. And that's something because everyone is putting this facade that, everything is fine. Look at me. Look at my position and that. But when you talk with them, I mean, as a coach as well, I mean, I get a lot of people who come and cry in my office here and just, and I say, but this is the different person from what they, you know, portray themselves as, you know, on social media, which is a challenge. And I really appreciate that. And maybe just two more last questions, and then we'll close it off. The first one is, there are especially leaders who are looking forward to become leaders. They it's their goals and it's their dreams to become leaders, either women or men, you know, but especially maybe let's look at women leaders. I know you can just put a, you know, like maybe just because skills are the same. What advice would you give that person who wants to be, you know, in your position one day and beyond even? What did you say? I mean, like when you come in as a leader, what skills do you need to have or traits or characteristics
to be
an effective leader?
That's an easy one.
Yeah.
So, and for me, I see a leader in everybody.
Yeah.
Because I see... If you don't have people that you are managing, you're a leader of yourself.
Yes.
So I think, and I am also a judge on Rising Star. So this is an easy one because I give people this advice every year.
Please, now they're going to get it here.
So for me, it's really about stay true to who you are.
Yeah.
Do not let an organization change you.
Yes.
Do not what you think people's expectations of you are change you. Stay through. Sometimes it's not going to be the popular. It's not going to be the popular view.
Yes.
And sometimes you need to be brave and you need to be courageous to be able to say, "This is not for me, and I am not doing this." Because a lot of the times when people go into the corporate organizations, there are politics being played.
Absolutely.
And some of those politics are that you need to be a certain way to be liked, to be in the in-group. And it's so easy that when you are young and when you are ambitious,
yes.
that you are going to get caught up in it.
Mm.
And you're going to lose yourself along the way. And when you're going to look back at it at some stage of your life, you're going to regret because there's so many people that people hurt whilst they're busy climbing the corporate ladder.
Yes.
There may be other people that's ahead of you on the ladder and you throw them down.
Yes.
And for me, it's about just stay true to yourself. Yes, you may not always end up where you want to be, but when you look back, you've helped and you've pushed some people up.
Wow, Padelia, that is just so powerful. And many people forget that. And it ends up becoming about them, you know, not helping people. The first black the special black. You've heard of those, you know, like the unique black. You know, we want to be, I'm the first one to have done that. I'm the only one who has that. I'm the only first female, you know, leader in my organization. And you're pushing others down. And I think it's such things that we need to look at. And I thank you so much for that. And maybe the last question. Now, when everything is all said and done, now you've reached the end of your career, what legacy would you like to leave behind? You know, what would you like to be known for? You know, where people will say, Bedelia Yenesin is.
That's also an easy one. Last year, I was close to death, so I did write up what my legacy is.
You were close.
I was very close twice in last year to death. So for me, it's being known as the person that was there to listen and to really listen and to show care. And yes, I couldn't always help everybody, but I was there to listen for them. And I gave them my honest opinion, which wasn't always, you know, what people wanted to hear. But I've had also a lot of people that would come back and say, you know, had it not been for you, X, Y, Z wouldn't have happened. But for me, I think it's about giving the best of me in the time that I spend with you. So as I'm sitting here with you, it's about being fully present and making you feel that you are the only person in the world at this stage. And then my other legacy that I would like to leave in the world is I've got three amazing boys.
Yes.
And I would like their wives to feel the upbringing that they've had, the lessons that I've given them, and for them to personally feel and experience it. And then obviously filtering into my future grandchildren, whether I would know them or not.
Wow. Ladies and gentlemen, when you talk about legacy, we're talking about the living spirit that you leave behind or that lingers behind and touch people's lives long after you're gone. And that's what legacy is all about. And I'm just so grateful once again for your time, Bedelia. And when I spoke with you, you just hit at the call. You said, "Veli, yes, I'm going to be there. I'd like to contribute, you know, to our world and to make sure that leadership becomes, you know, not just the fashionable thing, but it becomes something that is authentic, something that is real, something that is transformed." And I really appreciate you for that, because many people at times that you reach out to, they are forever busy. And then you wonder and say, wow, okay, forever busy. And yet they've got time for other things that are not really adding value. And I think for me, Velindaba, from a place of transformation, from transforming leaders from a place of leadership darkness to leadership light, it's been such a great pleasure. And I'm sure that this is a treat for you as well. And for me, it's about coming up with science, coming up with, you know, that data that supports whatever it is that we are talking about. And I've got a lot of it, and it's also in here. And when you talk about these things of transformation, it's not just something to make other people feel good, or just something that, you know, it's nice to talk about, because talk is cheap, but it's really about doing things that are meant to be done. And for me, Velindaba, the neuro engineer, I'm signing out from this episode. Thank you very much for joining us, and have a great day further.